This episode of Gunblog Varietycast brought to you by LawOfSelfDefense.com. Go to LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety to learn about your state's self-defense laws. Sign up for one of their online or in-person seminars or buy the book Law of Self-Defense and get 10% off when you use the discount code VARIETY at checkout. That's LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety. Sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, episode 89. Welcome back to the Gunblog Variety Cast. I'm Sean, and I'm joined as always by Adam. How are you doing, Adam?
I have mostly stopped reading politics, which means my blood pressure is significantly lower than it used to be. Is there anything going on that I should know about?
Well, there was Trigglypuff.
There was a what now?
Trigglypuff.
What is a Trigglypuff?
Did you see the video of Steven Crowder where he just lit into the social justice warriors for interrupting and being just giant pains in the behinds? Some in Boston. I can't remember what college it was, but basically he just ripped them up. Did you see that video? It just like totally went viral.
I did, in fact, see that video because I've mostly stopped reading politics and not entirely.
Right. But that wasn't like political. That was just like, oh my God, funny. So like that crossed over even to people who weren't even interested in politics. It was like, oh my God, somebody tried to heckle and got burned by the dude on the stage. Well, do you remember how he said, you know, the person who was flipping people off?
Right.
Right. The person he was pointing at was Trigglypuff. And Trigglypuff, all I can really say is Google Trigglypuff. And there's this video of this unfortunately panoramic woman with what kind of sort of looks like a mohawk, but turns out not to be. It's just a strange haircut. And she appears to be having an emotional breakdown and is screaming obscenities and telling them to go away and stop screaming hate speech or something. I'm not really certain, but it's like a two-year-old in an adult body screaming things that don't make a lot of sense. And it's kind of insane.
Well, okay. You're not making me miss the whole not reading politics much.
But it is funny. And when Christina Hoff Sommers is on stage and is talking,
stop talking to us like children!
And she was triggered. So that's how she got her name, Trigglypuff. Jigglypuff is apparently a Pokemon character. This I did not know.
I'm too old for Pokemon.
I am way too old for Pokemon. But apparently it's a portmanteau of Trigger and Jigglypuff.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, okay then.
So let's get started with the Tactical Dog and Fitness Report. 25.8 dog walking miles, and we're completely moved into the new house. Everything's out of the old house and into the new house. It's just not out of the boxes yet.
Well, 3 years later, I'm still sitting in a room full of boxes, so good luck with you there.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. That stuff's coming out of the boxes, let me tell you. Anything that doesn't come out of the boxes is going to be in storage in the attic.
Well, good luck. So I had decided to start Couch to 5K again. Longtime listeners will remember me complaining that every time I start to run, I decide, okay, tomorrow morning I'm going to start running. Well, then that's the night that the baby decides that he's going to get up 3 or 4 times.
Or you get sick.
Or I get sick or, you know, something like that. But anyway, so he did get up 3 times, but it was 3 times like before 11 p.m. Oh. So that was helpful. So I ran, you know, about 2.5 miles that next day. And then my knee has been hurting ever since Monday.
Wait, the first day you ran 2.5 miles.
I did 2.5 miles and some of that was running.
Oh, okay.
And then that evening my Jeep started bleeding. And so I've been using all of my spare time trying to fix that.
Oh, Lord. We'll get back to this whole having a project thing later in the podcast, I think. And now it's time for blue collar prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron Paulette. This week, Aaron asks, what's your disaster personality?
Come on, everypony! It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Aaron Paulette!
Okay, Aaron, I'll bite. What's a disaster personality?
You've heard the phrase, character is what you are when nobody's watching? Well, in a similar fashion, your disaster personality is who you become when the chips are down and, as the kids say, shit gets real. According to Amanda Ripley, author of the book The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why, everyone in an emergency situation goes through what she calls a survival arc that consists of three elements: denial, deliberation, and the decisive moment. How quickly you go through these stages defines your disaster personality. Many people get stuck on denial. They refuse to believe that anything is wrong and go about their business until they die. While you might think this is rare, it is actually amazingly common. Ask any firefighter and they will tell you stories about rolling up to a structure fire in a place like a bar or a restaurant, only to find people sitting calmly at their tables, carrying on as if everything is fine. John Leach, the author of Disaster Psychology, notes that in an emergency, about 75 to 80% of people will do nothing at all. While this may seem boneheadedly stupid, there is at least some overall survival benefit to an action. Sometimes, freezing and playing dead is the best way to survive an attack. If you aren't moving, you may not be noticed, and many predators won't eat something that isn't struggling because already dead meat could be diseased. In fact, this is how Clay Violin survived the Virginia Tech shooting. The other reason people do nothing in a disaster is because of something known as normalcy bias. Put simply, that's the belief that because something has never happened to a person, they can't imagine it happening, and therefore it will not happen. People with normalcy bias cannot react to any emergency situation which they have not personally experienced, despite what the news or their own senses tell them. Normalcy bias, incidentally, is why we have fire drills in buildings. It allows people to experience the possibility of a fire without endangering them, in the hopes that when the bell rings for real, they will be able to accept that it's actually a fire and act appropriately. Procrastination is also part of the delay phase. In emergencies, people will often tidy up or methodically gather belongings in order to give themselves a few more minutes of normalcy. Again, this is deeply rooted in ancient brain behavior. Not only does this delay give your conscious mind more time to process what's going on, the gathering of materials is actually a survival mechanism meant to ensure that you have sufficient provisions to survive the disaster. Unfortunately, this behavior often manifests in strange ways. People will pick up books or files at work, and passengers aboard mass transit will try to save their luggage despite the delay and blockage that it causes. This desire to gather is an excellent reason for having a get-home bag at work or a bug-out bag at home. Instead of wasting precious time gathering supplies, you can grab your bag and think, okay, I'm set with provisions, let's go on to the next step. The good part of this gathering process is that it means a person is edging their way to the second phase of disaster response, deliberation. When a disaster happens, people are likely to seek information from different sources about what is happening instead of acting. On 9/11, people in World Trade Center 1 waited 3 to 5 minutes before they started evacuating. This is because they spent that time gathering belongings and speaking to others about what was happening. They checked the internet, called family members, sent emails, and talked with coworkers about what to do instead of evacuating. An excellent example of this is a man named Louis Leshy. He was in the North Tower, and despite the building shaking and the noise of an explosion and the smell of fire, he and a group of 5 other people sat in a conference room and debated what to do for 20 minutes. If someone hadn't found them and told them, hey, we're evacuating, let's go, he might have stayed there and died. I encourage everyone to read the transcript of his interview with CNN that I've linked in the show notes. This tendency to deliberate is why people like flight attendants and emergency personnel yell at people to move. Without this direction, people have a tendency to mill about in emergencies, talking about what is going on instead of acting. Emergencies bind people into groups, and it's very common to fall into groupthink in a stressful situation. Fortunately, this also means that groups are easily led to safety by someone with confidence. Again, this is an ancient survival trait that's come back to haunt us in the modern day. By staying in groups, we made it hard for predators to kill us, whereas a lone hominid going off by itself could be more easily eaten by a lion. The lesson that preppers need to take from this is that it is necessary to have a plan of action before the emergency. Knowing what to do removes the desire to deliberate and seek consensus before deciding upon a course of action. The final stage of the survival arc is taking decisive action. In an emergency, only 20 to 25% of people will act, but at least half of them will do the wrong thing, such as going up on the roof to escape a fire or running away in a panic. And say what you will about panic, at least it's an action. So in order to take correct action, your disaster personality needs to be refined in the following ways. Have the proper attitude. Avoid normalcy bias, or the belief that if something bad happens, there's nothing you can do. And instead, teach yourself to be proactive. Believe that you can influence events, find purpose in this chaos, and learn from both positive and negative experiences. Be correctly informed. Pay attention to in-flight safety briefings, learn where emergency exits are in buildings, and generally pay attention to your surroundings so you don't get lost. Keep fear and anxiety under control. Back in episode 69, I talked about combat breathing and how that diminishes the fear which prevents clear thinking. Don't let fear eat at you by wondering what caused the event or what it means for the future. Instead, focus on what you need to do to survive now. There will be plenty of opportunities later to find out what happened. The toughest one here is be in shape. Much of survival depends on the ability to quickly move, sometimes up or down stairs or through narrow openings. Anything you can do to improve your mobility and flexibility also increases your chances of survival. On 9/11, people with low physical abilities were 3 times as likely to be hurt while evacuating the towers. And finally, have training. Practice improves your performance, especially under stress. Train your brain and your muscles now, and they will perform better when you must make quick and accurate decisions. Having skills you are proficient with is the fastest way to go from, "What do I do?" to, "I know what to do, everyone follow me," in a disaster. If you pay attention to these 5 steps, your disaster personality will be one of decisive action instead of denial or deliberation.
All right, Aaron. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
If you'd like to read more from Aaron, check out her blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com.
Felons behaving badly. Man accused of brutal assault on female. A South Carolina man is accused of assaulting a Gastonia woman. Gastonia police arrested suspect 22 of Clover, South Carolina, on Friday afternoon. He is charged with misdemeanor assault inflicting serious injury. The alleged incident occurred April 3rd in a parking lot of a Wendy's restaurant at 2419 West Franklin Boulevard in Gastonia. A warrant for a suspect's arrest was issued the same day. According to warrants, suspect is accused of punching and kicking a 31-year-old woman all over her body. Warrants also allege suspect slammed the woman's head against a vehicle, causing a large head wound that required a CT scan and measures to stop the bleeding. He is being held in Gastonia County Jail on $1,500 bond.
$1,500 bond? That's kind of low.
Well, it's only a misdemeanor.
All right, so in North Carolina, I can slam a woman's head against a car so hard that it requires medical attention to stop the bleeding.
Don't forget the CT scan.
And also the brain scan to make sure that there's no brain damage, and that's a misdemeanor assault. What is a felony assault?
I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that if somebody takes me and bashes my head against a car, I can use a gun to stop them from doing that again.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
And he's from South Carolina.
Right.
That's what it said. He's from Clover, South Carolina. But let's look at his North Carolina criminal record. Possession of a firearm by a minor, misdemeanor class 2. Operate a vehicle without a license, misdemeanor class 2. Hit and run, misdemeanor class 1. Possess Schedule 6, misdemeanor class 1. Possession with intent to sell, Schedule 2, felon class H. And common law robbery, felon class G.
Well, I'm sure that misdemeanor assault on a female charge will just straighten him right up.
Since Obama is doing such a fine job leading our country, he thought it might be a great idea to go to Britain and tell them how to run their country. In our Foreign Policy for Grownups segment, I asked Nikki how that went over. Nikki, The president recently took a trip to Great Britain to try to talk the Brits out of leaving the European Union. We've talked before about the so-called Brexit, and why Britain might want to remain in the EU, and why they might want to leave. What was the British reaction to the president's speech?
As you may well imagine, they didn't react real well. I mean, you remember when the Pope was here last year and he was all lecturing us on any number of things, including immigration, and people were pretty incensed that he was telling us what to do in our own country? How do you think the Brits reacted to Obama going out there and lecturing them on their own nation's destiny, eh? London Mayor Boris Johnson was particularly strident. He's very much anti-EU, and he doesn't appear to like our president much either. He actually called him a Kenyan recently. He caught a lot of flack for that. So there was this snotty op-ed Obama published in the London Telegraph recently, and in it he acknowledged that ultimately the decision about whether to stay in the EU or exit is up to the people of Britain. Fine. But then, of course, there's a but. We have this special relationship, you know, and because we do, we can go over there and impose our opinions on them, because that's what friends do, see? Boris Johnson angrily replied in an angry op-ed of his own, in which he wrote, "It is incoherent, it is inconsistent, and yes, it is downright hypocritical. The Americans would never contemplate anything like the EU for themselves or for their neighbors in their own hemisphere. Why should they think it right for us?"
Well, he's got a point. Why is it so important for us that Britain remain in the EU?
Well, for one, the EU writ large is a significant trade partner for the United States. In fact, the EU is our largest trading partner. If Britain exits the EU, we'd have to negotiate a separate trade deal with them. Our exports to the EU would drop, so Obama made a not-so-veiled threat on that recent trip. If Britain exits, it could take as long as 10 years to negotiate a separate trade deal with Britain, and the Brits were definitely not happy with that. Also, I think there's a defense component there, too. Remember when Bob Gates left the Pentagon, he delivered a pretty blunt message to the rest of NATO? You guys need to increase your defense spending so that the onus of collective defense doesn't squarely fall on the shoulders of the United States. So the EU has its own defense agency, it has its own military and its own common security and defense policy. Maybe the president is thinking this is one way to reduce the onus that's constantly placed on the United States as the leader of NATO. If Britain exits the EU, the EU's military becomes that much weaker, and NATO and the United States would be forced to step in. The stronger the EU, the less the European nations will turn to NATO. That's a possibility, too. Also, there's the volatility. The United States doesn't like discord and uncertainty. Having Britain exit the EU would certainly cause some Sturm und Drang for our allies at a time when the world faces some pretty significant threats, including a rather frisky Vladimir Putin and a resurgent, more aggressive Russia.
But ultimately, it's up to the British to vote. We talked the last time about the odds being fairly even that the vote would go either way. Has anything changed?
Well, I've seen a variety of polls lately. The Telegraph reported on 19 April that 52% polled would prefer to remain, 43% want to leave, and 5% weren't sure. I saw this other tracker from the political prediction market that said it was quite different. 69% were predicting an exit. On April 12th, out was actually ahead of in by 3 points, with 12% undecided. In other words, it's pretty much anyone's guess as to what will happen.
Given that the British are more than a little unhappy about Obama sticking his nose into their business, how is this affecting our special relationship?
Ooh, that was hot. No, it's a problem. Their press called Obama's siding with the EU a full frontal attack. Boris Johnson, the aforementioned mayor of London, slammed Obama as perverse. Tory MP Dominic Raab labeled Obama a lame duck president. I also saw an article dubbing him the most anti-British president. I mean, what did he expect after he went over there, issued not-so-veiled threats about trade, and then oh so magnanimously said that, well, even if the Brits exit the EU, intelligence sharing wouldn't be affected. The Brits were like, yeah, don't do us any favors, bud. I really do think this little trip to lecture the Brits on their future was a mistake, and it's going to impact U.S.-British relations for the next president, whoever that might be.
All right, Nikki. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
You bet. Take care.
Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com.
Plug of the week. So I finally spent the money and bought the leash I've been looking for my dog. I've been fighting it and fighting and fighting it with this stupid extendo retracto leash. You know, I don't know what they call them, but you know, the 25-foot little button and retracto leash things.
Yeah, so that they can get up to full speed running after that rabbit before you actually have a chance to stop them?
No, I'm actually pretty good at using those things. The ordinary person that uses them, they use them mostly to trip people on, you know, walking paths.
Yes.
I've always been pretty good at operating them, but that's because I actually walk my dog more than once a week.
Right.
I always wanted a traffic leash, you know, a short, just long enough to walk the dog right at your side with a loop. The problem is that then how does the dog pee? I'm going to stand right on top of the dog while the dog does her business? Got to give her a little space, right? Am I going to carry two leashes?
No.
And every time I've looked for a leash that has two handles on it, it's got a traffic leash length little loop, and then it's got the second loop, and it's like 6 feet long. Like 6 feet? That's not really very long. Well, I finally found a leash that was 8 feet long and had a traffic loop at about 2 feet. I'm like, well, that's what I want right there. Well, it sat for basically forever in my Amazon wish list. And as we were moving into the house, for one reason or another, we needed a couple of items, and they didn't add up to the $25. And some of the items that we were asking for were those add-on items in Amazon, and you got to get $25 to get the add-on items free shipping. I was like, I need to buy something else. And I'm going through my list of stuff to get. And finally I said, well, hey, you know, there's the leash. That'll put me over $25. And it's a $13 leash or something like that. So I said, all right. I'll get this leash. I've been walking this dog on this leash for 2 weeks now, and it is awesome. It is everything I ever wanted a leash to be. I've got a loop that I can just throw around my wrist at exactly the right length. If you've ever watched any Cesar Millan, you know, the tension on the leash is tension on the dog or something like that. Basically, you want just to relax, right? You know, relax, the dog will relax, just walk. And so I've always just, you know, wanted to loop and put my hand in my pocket and relax. And I've always ended up having to give too much slack on the dog. The dog has plenty of room to wander around, and then it just irritates the crap out of me. Well, I've got this traffic loop that's 2 feet long. It's a perfect length for my dog, who's a fairly tall dog. I mean, you know, you understand this.
Yes.
Light bodied dog. Even at 56 pounds, my dog's fairly tall for that size. So it's perfect. And then when it's time for her to do her business, I've got 8 feet of leash that I can just hold one end of, and she's got a little bit of room to find the just the right spot. You know, it can't be that blade of grass. That blade of grass doesn't smell right. This blade of grass is the right blade of grass. Oh God!
And then she pees 3 feet behind it.
And then, you know, I'll just throw the traffic loop back on, and off we go down the road. And I've got perfect control over when I need it. There's no tension on her, and she doesn't have a lot of room to roam, but she's got enough so that she can be where she needs to be, but not, you know, so close that she is, oh, I got to pull away because I'm going to get stomped on. It's everything I've ever wanted in a leash. I totally recommend this thing. I've got two in the show notes. One's red and one's black. They're both sold by the same company. And I've also got one link from Jetstorm. And if you look at the pictures they're showing look identical to the leash that I have. They actually look closer to the leash that I have than the pictures of the leash that I actually bought, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
If you look at the pictures that they have of the leash that I bought, they don't look like the leash that I bought. The pictures of the Jetstorm leash look exactly like the leash that I bought. And there's other colors available that are also listed as 8 foot long leash. You'll be interested to note that the leash that I have is red, not the purple Jetstorm leash, because Dicis's collar and therefore her leash and all her accessories are red.
How did you let that happen?
That's just what she ended up with.
Okay.
Just because I have everything in purple doesn't mean Dices needs to have everything in purple.
You don't want to be all matchy-matchy with your doggy? No?
Not necessary. She knows who she lives with. My wife's colors are blue. That's what happens when you do medieval reenactment. You know, everybody picks their colors. And it's not like the dog really knows.
Right? Being well, colorblind and all.
Well, no, dogs aren't really colorblind. They're color deficient in certain ways. But
yeah, we call that colorblind.
No, no. Everybody assumes that dogs see in black and white, and they don't. They're only very slightly color deficient. Orange, they don't see orange very well is what it is.
Right. Right. Orange looks so like people who are red-green colorblind, we don't call them color deficient. We call them colorblind.
Right. That's because we're wrong. In any case, you can get in a number of different colors, red and black from the same company that I purchased it from. And then there's other colors from this Jetstorm company. Not sure what's available from them, but the red one and the black one, they're awesome. So give it a try. If you have a dog, get one. I do not recommend that you use a harness like they show in the picture. I think harnesses, unless you have a sled dog, there's no good reason to put a harness on a dog. All that does is make it easier for your dog to tow you around, which, of course, if you have a sled, great plan. If you want your dog to tow you around, a harness is a great idea. Otherwise, put a collar on your dog. Beth gets to go to all the cool events. She's back to tell us about another one she attended, the Well-Armed Woman Mid-South Purple Powwow.
Hey, Sean, I hope you're doing well. I know we've had some craziness with schedules over the last couple weeks, but it's great to be back and to share something that actually happened to me over this past weekend. I had the opportunity to travel to Raymond, Mississippi and attend the very first Mid-South Purple Powwow. Now, I'm sure people are asking, what is a purple powwow? Well, the best way to describe it is it's an event that was put together for members and leaders of the Well-Armed Women, specifically members and leaders who are in the southern states of Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas. Of course, the Well-Armed Woman is a national organization that is known for educating, equipping, and empowering women, especially in the area of firearms and firearms training. I am a co-leader of our Trustville chapter here in Alabama, but I also have the honor of being on the Well-Armed Woman competitive shooting team. Now, me on a competitive shooting team is actually a little bit funny because I have not been doing this for a long time. Competitive shooting is really relatively new to me since I've only been doing this, oh gosh, about a year and a half. But I had the opportunity this weekend to share with all these ladies in attendance just a little bit about what it's like to get out there and shoot in one of these matches. Now, we were at the beautiful Boondocks range there in Raymond, Mississippi, and it's a fantastic facility. It was actually put together by a friend and fellow Well-Armed Woman chapter leader, Kim Condon, and her husband, and you can just tell that there was so much thought put into this whole place, the whole design. It's funny because even the restrooms and even the toilet paper, you can tell a woman had her special touch on that. And that's a great thing because even nowadays, one of the most important things that a shooting range or even a gun store can have is a clean restroom that their women patrons can utilize. And we're not talking porta potties. We're talking about a nice restroom. At any rate, I had a chance to share three of the competitions that I typically shoot in, and I wanted to just talk about those very briefly today. One of the competitions I shared was the IDPA, which is, of course, the International Defensive Pistol Association. A lot of people out there probably compete in this regularly, and I just wanted to share with the ladies just a great way to increase your level of training with your gun, even your everyday gun. When I got started with IDPA, I actually showed up with my everyday gun in a Damask Kydex holster, not really having any clue about tactical belts and all the gear that a lot of people use in competitions. So I went out there with my everyday gun and just shot through all those stages and felt very confident and very proud of myself for having the opportunity to train that way. So that just goes to show you, you don't really have to have all the gear. You don't have to have all the gadgets. You can go out there just as you are and get a chance to kind of feel that stress and that adrenaline and what could very well be like real life scenarios and moving and shooting and transitioning between different targets. And of course, making sure that you don't hurt any of those non-shoots or hostages, however you want to look at it. Another type of competition I was able to share was the Steel Challenge. And I love the Steel Challenge because it's such a great place for people to start out. If they're looking to get into competition or they're looking to be able to shoot something besides just paper, this is a great starting place. You don't have to move and shoot. You stand in one place and you engage five steel targets. And of course, you've got that immediate feedback. You either have the ring of that bullet hitting, or of course, you have silence, which gives you the opportunity to go back and hit it again, hopefully within the allotted time. The final kind of competition that I was able to share was a little bit of three gun. And this is something brand new to me, but I absolutely love it. And I really feel like even though I'm not really keen on competitions in and of themselves, I surely get that shooter's high after a three gun match or a three gun stage. It's just so exhilarating to be running around there with pistol, shotgun, and rifle and engaging all these different targets. And of course, dealing with that kind of stress that your body is going through and that adrenaline dump. All in all, the real reason for me to compete is not because I'm an expert or I think I'm going to win any trophies. I don't think I've won anything yet except for learning experiences. But that's exactly why I do this. And that's exactly why I would encourage other people, especially ladies, to get out there and try it. You know, don't be scared to get out there and take on this kind of a challenge. It is so good for you to be able to expand your abilities and your capabilities and try something new with your training and your practice. You never know what that scenario is going to be like if you ever have to defend yourself. So I feel much more confident having gone through all these crazy scenarios and stages and all these different competitions because it's really challenged me. I've really had to up my game and I've really had to improve myself both physically and mentally. And of course, competitions are a great way to showcase that shooting really is, I think, 80% mental and maybe 20% physical. So it's been able to help me with my mindset and help me get into that line of thinking and help me get over the fear and the trepidation and the anxiety that I have just about competition in and of itself. So there you have it. That was my weekend kind of in a nutshell with the Purple Powwow and sharing some different competition shooting with other ladies. And I'm just sharing it here as well in case anybody out there has been wanting to get out there and try something new or just wanting to try their hand at competitive shooting. So give it a try. And until then, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
Fun with headlines.
Police. Gun found under cushion where baby was sleeping. Couple charged.
Well, I mean, you know, the cops found a gun underneath the baby's cushion, so they charged him for that, right?
Right, right. And they knew that the gun was there because they had a hunch. Because
Grandma told them, hey, Grandma says, hey.
Or they posted it on Facebook or something, right? So that was...
Probably.
So, or maybe they were just, you know, hey guys, how you doing? I'm Officer Friendly. I just come to do a safety check. Oh, what is this? Oh, that's not good. You shouldn't do that. Or, Metro Police say a mother and father have been charged with aggravated child neglect after leaving a loaded gun under the couch cushion where their one-year-old son lay sleeping. According to arrest warrants, detectives served a narcotics search warrant at the home of 37-year-old Suspect 1 and her husband, 46-year-old Suspect 2, on Wednesday afternoon. During the search, they discovered a loaded 9mm pistol underneath the cushion where the infant was sleeping. The gun was reportedly stolen. Police say a stolen 12-gauge shotgun was also found in the child's room. Court documents state officers also found marijuana and cocaine in the home and allege the two were selling it. I guess that's hence the narcotics warrant. Both Suspect 1 and Suspect 2 face multiple charges, including aggravated child neglect, felony drug possession, and theft of property. Suspect 2's bond was set at $75,000, and Suspect 1 was set at $59,000. Both are due in Davidson County Criminal Court on Friday. But the lead is there was a gun and a baby. Oh no.
I think maybe the baby swiped the gun and put it underneath the pillow for safekeeping.
Maybe he did. They did say it was stolen.
By the baby.
By the baby. Clearly.
And here I thought that a light was just a light. Well, just like a battery isn't just a battery, Sig is back to tell us that a shop light isn't just a shop light, in?
Tech tips. Tech tips. Tech tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech tips
with Silicon Graybeard.
So what's up this week, Sig?
This time we have a new path to explore. Listener John from Philly emailed me to ask if I could talk about LED lights. In particular, he asked about shop lights. LED lighting is a field that everyone is familiar with to some degree, but it's got some gotchas and subtleties to it. The first gotcha that people trip over is that the way we're used to talking about lighting is frankly all wrong for this purpose.
How do you mean?
Take a conventional incandescent light bulb. It's rated by the amount of power it uses in watts. That's only useful if you're comparing two similar bulbs, like a 60 or 100 watt reading light. What you really care about is how much light output it produces, and that's given in lumens. Just know that even with a conventional incandescence, you would find things like two 60-watt bulbs with very different output in lumens. Now, you can't just convert watts to lumens, so some typical numbers are handy to know. A 60-watt bulb like we used to get for desk lamps usually puts out about 800 lumens, and when you buy a 60-watt equivalent LED bulb, it's going to be around 800 lumens. A 100-watt bulb is closer to 1,600 lumens. Maybe you have or you had the old three-way bulbs with 60, 100, and 150 watts. 150-watt bulbs put out 2,600 lumens. That's roughly one, two, or three 60-watt bulbs in one. If you read the package, you'll see that a 60-watt LED is really using about 12 or 15 watts to deliver that 800 lumens. The difference between 60 watts and 15? That's the energy efficiency. If you're one of those folks who collect tactical flashlights like they're candy, you're probably used to numbers of lumens. Surefire, Phoenix, and all of them rate flashlights by the number of lumens they put out. Same idea. Now, the term shop light has lots of different meanings. Amazon is full of small, pointable lights made by the tool companies like Snap-on or DeWalt or Ryobi and so on. Likewise, anyone can buy a bulb socket with a reflector around it that can clamp onto things and use that. The woodworking store Rockler carries some LED bulbs that are built into reflector shrouds that put out 2,500 or 4,400 lumens. There's a wide range of small LED lights that clamp onto tools or have a magnetic base, and they produce a spot which can be pointed where your tools are cutting. Really, it's a matter of choosing the form factor you like. I have a couple of eye-gauging lights which double as focusable flashlights when they're not held to any steel tool with a magnetic base. They put out 300 lumens from three AAA batteries, and the flexible stand allows you to point it where you're working. You can see the show notes. Now, 300 lumens is a good output for a flashlight when you're outside at night, but it's less than a 40-watt bulb, to mix our systems again. I find it adds enough light to critical places, though, like the chuck of my lathe or the point of the drill, to make work easier to see. It doesn't have to be this sort of light, of course. Many of us bought shop lights that are a pair of fluorescent bulbs and a sheet metal fixture that we hang from our ceiling in our garage or whatever. There are LED replacements for the 48-inch fluorescent bulbs that these use, either as complete fixtures or just as replacement bulbs. In the package of a T8 fluorescent bulb, you'll find a string of LEDs, usually with some power supply parts. Now be careful here, because many of these require you to modify or replace the light fixture. Fluorescent fixtures use a part called a ballast that you have to remove for these bulbs. There are LED replacements that don't require that you do anything to the fixture. Again, there's some in the show notes. I can't say that I did a lot of shopping, but the two selections in the show notes have the replacement bulbs costing either $11 each if you remove the ballast and rewire the fixture, or $12 each for a plug-and-play light that doesn't care if you have the ballast in it. Sounds like a no-brainer to me. As always, asking an engineering question can get complicated. Here, asking if your LED replacement is going to put as much light where you want it isn't as simple as counting lumens they're rated for. T8 fluorescents put out about 2,950 lumens per bulb, and there's a range there. But there are other things to consider. They're omnidirectional, while the LEDs put the light out in one side only. And while both of them will lose some light output over time, the LEDs last longer. Some light always gets lost in the fixture with the fluorescent. One lighting engineer I've read says count on losing 35% of the rated lumens from a T8 fixture. So while the LEDs are rated at 2,200 lumens instead of the 2,950 the T8 is rated for, they have lower losses and they put more light where you want it. And if that's all too complicated, I put a couple of LED strips in my reloading area that are powered by a 12-volt wall wart. The nearest fluorescent fixture is far enough away that it's kind of dark in that spot, and two of these strips, and they're shown in the show notes, add enough light to make it more pleasant to work there, even though they're only about equivalent to a 30-watt bulb each. Perhaps you've seen the strips of white LEDs that seem to pop up everywhere, like Amazon or eBay or the flea markets. They usually come on a spool, and they're configured so that the strips can be cut to length and then hooked up to a 12-volt supply. every three LEDs are a circuit, so you just cut it where it's marked and solder on some wires for power. They're handy. I have a bunch of them myself, but I've never seen lumen ratings on them. I've seen guys use them to put lights inside their boats or on the cars or motorcycles, kind of more as an accent or a highlight than functional lighting. I would only caution that they seem to lose light output quickly if they're mounted on wood or non-metal. I mounted a few feet of LEDs on the edge of a wooden strip in my ham shack, and after a couple of years, they seemed to have gotten dark. The replacements were much brighter. I just really didn't know, but I'm guessing that being mounted on wood like that gave no way for the heat to be pulled out of the LEDs. Putting them on a metal strip to suck some of the heat out might help them last longer. Our listener asked a couple of other interesting questions that we'll take on next week.
All right, Sig. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next time.
You can read more from Silicon Greybeard at thesilicongraybeard.blogspot.com. That's Greybeard spelled G-R-A-Y-B-E-A-R-D, or email questions directly to sigraybeard, one word, at gmail.com.
The J-Block. Democrat pushes to expand secret gun confiscations in California. California Assemblyman Phil Ting, D. San Francisco, is pushing to expand firearm confiscations by allowing co-workers and others to file a complaint that sets the secret confiscation process in motion. The confiscations are tied to gun violence restraining orders. Gun violence restraining orders were touted as a vehicle through which families could petition a court for the seizure of guns from a family member. With order in hand, police could confiscate firearms from the family member without notice. The GVROs were signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown, Democrat, in October 1, 2014 and became effective January 1, 2016. Assemblyman Ting is now pushing Assembly Bill 2607 to expand GVROs so co-workers, employers, teachers, and others can petition a court to have secret confiscations ordered. In an April 27th press release, the Firearms Policy Coalition observed, Ting's bill massively expands a controversial law that has only been in place for 4 months. At present, current law permits family members and peace officers to petition a court, in secret, in order to restrain an individual from possessing firearms. AB 2607 compounds this measure by adding to the list of qualified petitioners, employers, co-workers, mental health workers, and employees of a secondary or post-secondary school. This would add thousands of people, including complete strangers, to the list of people who could petition a court to restrain a person from possessing firearms, triggering a warrant and armed law enforcement raids without trial, conviction, or opportunity to defend oneself before a court. Expanding the secret confiscation process to include teachers will have a chilling effect on gun owners who may not agree with the professor's point of view at the university, but refuse to speak up for fear of having their gun rights suspended. In the same way, gun owners with treatable mental health problems may be tempted to stay away from caregivers in order to ensure the uninterrupted continuation of their right to keep and bear arms.
So, what you're going to have is gun owners aren't going to be speaking up in college, and they're also going to be crazy anyway. So, win-win for everybody.
Yep.
Because they're already crazy because they own guns.
That's really kind of how they view it. If you want to own a gun, that's right there proof that you're crazy and shouldn't own a gun.
Right.
If we take a look at Assembly Bill 2607, which we will have in the show notes so that you can look at it yourself, I'm a big believer in let's read the bill itself. Because it's easy for people to say, oh my goodness, this is what it's going to do, and really it doesn't say that. But in this case, pretty much what they said was true. An immediate family member, an employer, a coworker, a mental health worker who has seen the person as a patient in the prior 6 months, an employee of a secondary or post-secondary school that the person has attended in the last 6 months, or a law enforcement officer may file a petition requesting that the court issue an ex parte gun violence restraining order enjoining the subject of the petition from having in his or her custody or control, owning, purchasing, possessing, or receiving a firearm or ammunition. Now, ex parte orders.
That means you don't have to be there for them to issue the order against you.
Exactly. Basically, the way this goes is step one, somebody decides that you shouldn't have a gun and is on this list. Step two, they fill out an affidavit, which not as complicated as it sounds. An affidavit is merely a piece of paper that you sign that is a sworn statement. That's all it is. Let's see, section B, the court may issue an ex parte gun violence restraining order if the petition supported by an affidavit made in writing and signed by the petitioner under oath or an oral statement taken pursuant to subdivision of section, there's a number, and any additional information provided to the court shows that there is a substantial likelihood that both of the following are true. One, the subject of the petition poses a significant danger in the near future of causing personal injury to himself, herself, or another by having in his or her custody or control, owning, purchasing, possessing, or receiving of a firearm, as determined considering the factors listing in section, there's a section number. Two, an ex parte gun violence restraining order is necessary to prevent personal injury to the subject of the petition or another because less restrictive alternatives either have been tried and have been found to be ineffective or are inadequate or inappropriate for the circumstances of the subject of the petition. So basically, what that says is as long as you can convince the judge that it's a good idea and there's no better way to deal with it, you're golden.
And I have a feeling that there's judges in California where that wouldn't be too hard.
Well, I have a feeling that what that means is pretty much anybody who comes in and says, oh, my brother's crazy, and they're going to get the order, because who's going to say no to that?
Right. Who wants to be the judge that didn't sign the order that stopped, you know, the Virginia Tech shooter?
Right. One thing that I think is really interesting kind of a negative way, is Section D, the ex parte order under this chapter shall be issued or denied on the same day that the petition is submitted to the court, unless the petition is filed too late in the day to permit effective review, in which case the order shall be issued or denied on the next day of judicial business, insufficient time for the order to be filed that day with the clerk of the court. So basically, as long as I show up by 2 o'clock with the affidavit submitting, hey, please give me this, I can have your guns taken away from you by a close of business that day.
Right.
Boom. That's it. And they have to. I mean, like, how much time does that give anybody to review it? That's the end of your rights right there. But they don't believe that you have rights. Would they take away your right to free speech? Would they throw you in jail? Would they treat any other right that you have like this? Are they going to go through your house and take away your kitchen knives?
Well, don't tempt them.
Are they going to go and siphon all the gas out of your car so that you don't light Happy Land on fire?
Well, you shouldn't have a car anyway in California, right? You should be taking the bus.
Well, yeah, and also gasoline is a carcinogen and it probably should have a sign on your car.
Yes.
There is something that you can do about this. And that something that you can do is go to firearmspolicy.org, join Firearms Policy Center, and help them fight this. It's not just people who live in California. If you have any interest in seeing that firearms laws don't end up getting worse than they are, the place you need to fight it is places like California. I live in North Carolina. Gun laws in North Carolina are not that bad. They're not as good as they should be, but they're not that bad. So we're not on the cutting edge of how bad can it be. We're not where the battle really is. The battle is really in places like Hawaii and in New Jersey and in California. That's where the limits of the Second Amendment are going to actually be defined, in the places where they're trying to take the rights away. So join Firearms Policy Center, go to firearmspolicy.org, and follow the links and join. And now a word from our sponsor. You know what will happen. If you ever have to defend yourself, you're going to end up in handcuffs. Are you trained to win the fight after the fight? Sure, you can draw, aim, and put 2 in the 10 ring, but have you learned your legal self-defense? Do you know the law? Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for your legal self-defense class. Each class is tailored to the laws in your state. Attorney Andrew Branca will teach you the law. Not just what the law says, but what the judge's legal opinions say. What the jury instructions say. Sure, you could risk spending the rest of your life in prison because you followed the advice of some gun store counter jockey. Or you could spend the day with the man who literally wrote the book on the law of self-defense. Carry a gun so you're hard to kill. Know the law so you're hard to convict. Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for a legal self-defense class in your state. And make sure to use discount code VARIETY at checkout to receive 10% off.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the donate or subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Proving that it takes an order of magnitude more effort to debunk BS than it does to generate it, Weird finally finishes with Loaded Conversations Episode 1, in this week in anti-gun nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for me this week?
Okay, we got a bit sidetracked with my fisking of episode 3 of the Loaded Conversations podcast. Now it's time to finish off the first episode and maybe get onto something different. She starts off with a whopper on this one.
Since moving to Ohio, I feel like a week hasn't gone by without a gun incident, often not that far from where we live or where someone we know lives. Come to find out, the numbers bear out my growing feeling of insecurity. Massachusetts, with its strong gun laws and relatively low gun ownership, is second only to Hawaii in the fewest gun deaths per capita in the U.S., with about 3 deaths per 100,000 citizens per year. Ohio is right in the middle, with about 11 gun deaths per 100,000 per year, nearly 4 times as many as Massachusetts.
All right, we've covered this a bunch of times. Yep, Ohio has more gun deaths than Massachusetts. They also have more violent crime and suicide in general, gun or non-gun. Antis make the claim that more gun laws mean less crime and suicide, except the data is just a jumble. And depending on how you weight different gun control laws, the correlations can be weakly pointed in either direction. And of course, gun sales have been record-breaking, violent crime has been going down nationwide. Sorry, it's just not possible for your implications to be true. Also, let's note that she works with the Brady Campaign and is an anti-gun activist. Yes, you're going to be hearing about gun deaths in every single Facebook post because that's what anti-gun activists do.
My kids, active shootings and lockdowns are a part of their everyday conversations at school.
So this comes after some accounts of her kids telling about getting put on various school lockdowns and told to shelter in place when threats were perceived. I'm sorry, but my high school had fake bomb threats called in a few times. Has there ever been a school in the last 30 years where this hasn't happened? School protocols mean they have to believe you. There is so much effect for such little effort that it's going to happen. In Ohio, in Massachusetts, in Hawaii. But you're not doing a podcast on banning crank phone calls. And what's with her not questioning these policies? Her kids both told stories about being asked to hide under their desks like they did back in the 50s and 60s for the pending Soviet nuclear attack. These policies don't work and only lead to more death, not less, in the unlikely event of an active shooter. But she doesn't question it because she wants you to eat this crap so she can feed you more crap.
Nearly every gun control advocate can name their activation moment. Umpqua turned out to be mine. On that day, I myself had been teaching at a community college, so when I left school after classes, I didn't know anything about the shooting. I remember driving home thinking about one of my students, a quiet kid who seemed personally affronted by my request that he remove his earbuds while I was talking. I have to admit, I wondered if he owned or had access to a gun. I knew most of them did, and if he would maybe bring that gun to school, point it at my head, and say, "You can take these earbuds from my cold, dead hands," or something like that.
If you listened last week, you heard her insane violent daydreams at the gun range spoken about in episode 3. When she should have been concentrating on her sight picture and the 4 rules of gun safety, she was daydreaming about her kids and family getting shot for no damn reason. So there's something up with her that isn't quite right. Same goes with this. You big damn hero! You bravely told a student to take out their earbuds in class! Good thing he didn't have a gun! We've been hearing a lot of this sentiment as campus carry is gaining ground. But where have you heard about professors getting beaten down in class when tempers fly? If a student is getting so riled up that they're going to pull a firearm in class, why aren't they getting into enough of a rage to physically assault? Also, while guns may be banned, bats, pipes, steel-toed boots, and stones aren't. Yet no problem there. Guns are different. Because they're different.
When I got home and checked my Facebook feed, there it was, the mass shooting at Umpqua Community College. 10 dead, 7 wounded. Just about the number of students I'd had in class that day.
In a state where Michael Bloomberg had just run roughshod over, and in a college that banned guns.
I went online to see if I could find a podcast about gun violence. I just didn't know enough. Were fewer guns really the answer? Did, as my students and even some of my friends claim, a gun really protect you? Would new laws only ensure that so-called good guys would end up unarmed, leaving all our country's weapons in the hands of the bad guys? The answers all seemed so obvious to me. I couldn't at all understand the opposition to safe gun laws. Nor could I find a podcast on the issue. Oh, I found plenty of podcasts about guns.
And she probably didn't listen to any of them, because as she said, she was looking for a podcast to reinforce her wrong opinions and refute the correct points. It takes a special snowflake to do something like that, and she's that lady, as we've been hearing.
There's a whole network, for God's sakes, the Firearms Radio Network.
As you might know, I've done a bunch of work for this network. Jake has done a great job at building a successful podcast network from the ground up. Ironically, the selling point of this network is politics are not discussed on any of the shows. The shows are about guns, gun gear, and the shooting sports. No politics allowed. You go looking for answers to your political question, you've come to the wrong place.
And then there's Girl Gun Radio, featuring two women who work in Smith & Wesson's marketing department. Apparently, the talk on guns from a woman's point of view includes topics such as winter shooting fun, what the gun girls like to eat and cook, products and tools for gun cleaning, and an interview with the owner of Concealed Carry, spelled like the girl's name, a company that offers women a way to safely secure their firearms without sacrificing fashion.
It's actually Gun Girl Radio, not like she's paying any attention, as they aired their last episode back in August of 2014. And it was that Concealed Carry show! Also, these aren't just women in the Smith & Wesson marketing department. These are some of the top shooters in the world, male or female. And still, listen to that nasty tone she's taking. How dare women shooters act like normal human beings?
Suddenly, my mission was clear. I'd worked in radio while I was in DC, and I knew a little something about production. I had to get out there with my microphone and try to make sense of this whole gun violence stew.
And in almost 4 months, as of the time of this recording, she hasn't even broken 1 hour of audio on the subject. And she pads the show heavily with music, dead air, previews for next week, and then recaps from last week. And really, the bulk of what's left is her slinging smarmy insults at our side. Is there any doubt on why their side is having such a rough time? We have facts, and the laws, and the will of the people in our favor, while they have hand-wringing and misery. And that's just the politics. If you don't want to talk about politics and that stuff, we can just go have fun at the range. What do they do when they aren't talking politics but still want to stand up for their cause?
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
I'm just going to go ahead and say that lady needs a gun violence protection order. She does not need to be anywhere near firearms.
No guns. They should probably take away any sharp objects.
Gasoline.
They should probably clear out everything underneath her sink.
Maybe we should like let her husband know that she has fantasies about getting shot and her whole family violently dying.
And he's a doctor, so, you know, maybe he could talk to one of his colleagues about getting her some help.
Yeah, maybe. In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Stuff that grinds my gears. People who lose sight of the goal in the process of enjoying having a project.
I resemble that remark.
Well, I don't know if that's really you. I tease you about it, but really all you're doing is you like having a particular kind of car, and you like getting to and from work, and you have to keep the car running.
Yeah.
That's not quite the same thing. The particular thing that brought it to mind is something that happened between me and my wife this week. And I'm not really picking on my wife about this in particular. Unfortunately, she's kind of the one that's irritating me right now. I'm sure you're aware of this, that occasionally people who were married have a picture in their head of the way the world should be, and they haven't communicated that to their spouse. And this could go either direction. Frequently, it goes both directions. You have a picture in your head, your wife has a picture in her head. These two pictures are not the same, and neither of you have spoken to the other about them so that you can maybe combine these pictures in some way. I have a garage. For the first time in my life as an adult, now when I was a kid there was a garage, but it was in California. You don't park in a garage in California. A garage in California is a basement to everybody else on the planet, right? A basement is a place to put your crap.
Gotcha.
In California, they don't have basements. I'm not entirely certain why. I'm not an architect, but there are reasons that you don't dig holes in the ground in California and like build a house on top of it. I'm not entirely certain why you do it anywhere else. I think it has something to do with like digging underneath the frost line. They don't freeze in California, so there's no frost line. So you have a garage, but that's where all your crap lands. So you park outside. So I've never had a place to park a car. And I thought it'd be really cool to park my car in a garage. Because then I could be paranoid. I wouldn't have to go outside to my car. I could just walk out in the garage. I could get into my car. The door would be locked. I could push the button to open the garage. I could start the car and I could drive out. And then I could push the button. The garage door would close. I would never have to walk out my front door. It's awesome. In fact, I could count on one hand the number of times I have actually walked out my own front door. I walk out the garage because it's more convenient. So I don't want a lot of stuff in my garage. So I'm in my garage, I'm looking around, and I'm picturing shelves in my garage to put the stuff that inevitably is going to collect there. And I know it's going to happen. There's nothing that can be done about this. There's just stuff is going to expand to fill your space. It's just, well, apparently my wife had also been picturing shelves. And in the process of picturing this, she described the picture of the shelves. But did she describe this picture to me? No, she described it to her father, who is her project buddy, because her father was a contractor and they used to work together when she was little. And so that's who she does work in the shop with. And so the two of them are brainstorming this shelving unit, and I'm looking online for a commercial shelf that somebody could build parts to, put it in a box, and ship to my front door and drop in my driveway. And I would drag it inside in pieces, and I would build it on the weekend, and I would put my stuff on it. And it would be tank strong, and I could dance elephants on top of it. And no matter what I did to it, it would never fall over, and it would never collapse, because no matter how much crap I put on it, I could never possibly overload this stupid thing. That's what I wanted. It would fit in the corner, and it would be perfect. And that was the picture I had in my head. And then I wanted some workbenches because they sold workbenches too. I had this picture in my head. And did I communicate this picture to my wife? No, I did not. Because, of course, if I had the picture in my head and it was this perfect, beautiful, wonderful picture, obviously that picture would somehow osmose its way into my wife's head. And I guess my wife probably thought the same thing, is because as soon as she showed me the picture of this wonderful shelving unit she was going to build and put in the garage, I would say, that's wonderful, honey, that's perfect. And since I don't have to have anything to do with it, you can totally do that and I will be so happy. And it didn't go well. And I don't want a project. I want a shelving unit. I just want a place to put my stuff. And she doesn't want a shelving unit. She wants a project. She wants to work on a project with her dad. What bothers me about that is not the shelving unit and not my wife's differing opinions on how the shelf should be and sizes and all that other stuff. Though we could have our disagreements on that, we could work that out. The problem is what she really wants is a project. And what I really want is a shelving unit. And that's the fundamental disagreement, is that she wants a project. She wants something to work on with dad. And I can totally respect that, but not in my shelving unit. No! I'd rather have no shelving unit at all than your project. And I see people who really don't want something. They want a project. And I've run into that a number of times. So what about you, Adam?
We may have even talked about this before, but I'm not sure. I didn't check the archives. The cloud. I hate that term. You know what the cloud means? You're running stuff on somebody else's servers. That's all it means. That's all it means. There's nothing special about it. It's just the cloud. So we have this cloud initiative at my company, and they're like, oh, we have this cloud. I'm like, yeah, we've had it for like 12 years. What are you talking about? Oh, no, this is new and fancy, and look, we can do all this stuff. I'm like, yeah, oh, okay. But it's the cloud. No, it's just the same stuff that we've had for the last 10, 12, 15 years. You just put a new name on it. I don't understand. Oh, look, shiny cloud, buzzword. What?
It's just better marketing, you're saying.
Yeah. Don't fall for it. It's the same stuff. We've always had it. Always.
So instead of calling it a network drive, you're going to call it the cloud drive?
It's a cloud drive, yes.
Hey, if it makes people feel more comfortable.
Hey, you remember Hotmail? That's not webmail. That's the cloud. your email address at AOL.com? No, no, no. That wasn't like AOL email. That was the cloud.
Well, that's our show for the week.
Thanks again to Rob Allen for our music.
And Firearms Policy Coalition for their support.
And thank you for listening to the Gunblog Variety Cast.
Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at SeanSorrentino.com.
And hate mail to WizardPC at GunsCarsTech.com.
If you're not already subscribed, subscribe in iTunes for all you Apple users.
Or in Google Play Music or Stitcher Radio if you're an Android user.
And make sure to help us grow by sharing this podcast with your friends.
Show notes can be found at GunblogVarietyCast.com/episode89.
This is a URS production.